Today we're going to be completing, that is, this morning and tonight, we'll see the completion of our series on 1 Corinthians. We're now up to 1 Corinthians 15, which we've divided up into two parts because it's a long and a very full chapter on this great theme of the resurrection. So if you'd like to turn to that now, it's on page 167 in the Bible. We'll look at this second part, which deals with a question which some of the critics at Corinth have raised. And we'll find that question in verse 35 of 1 Corinthians 15. But someone will ask, how are the dead raised? And indeed, that's a very big question to ask. And it's puzzled men all through the ages, Christians and non-Christians. It's an interesting thing, but I would say that the majority of humanity at all times has been convinced deep down inside that there is immortality. This has been an almost universal conviction of the human race. But working that out in practice, understanding anything about how we survive as people after death, produces a lot of problems for non-Christians and for Christians. People have wrestled with it all through the ages. They were obviously wrestling with it at this time in Corinth. A lot of the thinkers at the time had got problems. And it was along this level that many of them criticized Christianity. Just a few hundred years later, the critic Celsus was saying about the Christian hope of resurrection, it is the hope of worms. Like these critics at Corinth, he had become convinced that the personality was so bound up with the body that once you looked at a decomposing body, you had to say the personality is dying as well. This, in fact, is a great modern argument against Christianity. It's the one that Bertrand Russell centers on in his book, Why I Am Not a Christian. And his great theme is that we know now from modern science more than anything else that personality is bound up in the body, in these living cells, in these atoms, in these electric currents, in my brain cells. That is where my personality lies. And it's very difficult to abstract it and talk about the spirit as something remote and different from the body. So when the body is dying, surely we have to say in the end the personality is dying. And yet, as I said at the beginning, in spite of this argument, many thinking people don't feel that that is necessarily true. That they feel that there is far more to life than what we can analyze scientifically. That we can look at many things both from a scientific and from a spiritual point of view. There is a sense in which you can't analyze something like love or joy or hope. They're beyond scientific analysis. And it is the conviction of the Christian, as of many non-Christians too, that the personality and the spirit is also something which is beyond scientific analysis. Nevertheless, we've got to face up to this argument thrown against Christianity that personality is bound up with the body. And if the body decomposes, how on earth does the personality survive? People have really looked at it from two completely opposite points of view. Probably the view that the critics of Paul had in their minds when they were writing these questions was the Greek view, which is still held today as a popular view, especially amongst Eastern religions. The idea, yes, that we do survive in a vague spiritual sense, but not really as individuals. You will not be you. I will not be I after death. We will somehow be reabsorbed spiritually back into the life force. Whether we call that life force God, or whether we don't even define the life force that definitely. This is an appealing view because it gets around the whole problem of our personality existing once our body is dead by emphasizing that we are somehow all part of the eternal spiritual creation, and so we are going to be bound back into the eternal spirit once we die, that is, once our body decomposes. The other view swings in totally the opposite direction. It's a much more popular view amongst people perhaps who don't think about the philosophical difficulties of life after death. People simply believe that there's going to be a total reconstruction of life as we know it here and now. This perhaps is the view of the Jehovah's Witnesses. If you look in their books, their illustrations of the new earth are just a reconstruction of life here on earth. Our bodies look the same, the animals look the same, but it's just a paradise existence, but similar, identical to the one we are living here and now, with sin taken away. It's, I think, a popular view amongst certain Orthodox Christians. The idea that when you bury somebody, one day you'll see them again in their same old baggy suit and their same carpet slippers. It's appealing to our deep longing to remain united with those we love. And I'm not in any way condemning this view as such. But we've got to think more deeply and realize there is more to resurrection than that. It's a view, I suppose, that the Egyptians had when they buried their pharaohs, like Tutankhamun, complete with money, pots, pans, and clothes, and everything they were going to need for the next life. It was looking upon the next life as a simple reconstruction of the material world they have departed from. Now, Paul argues that both these views are wrong. He says we do not receive back our physical bodies as such. Neither are we going to be absorbed into some mystical life force. We are going to retain our personality and retain our individuality. You will still be you. I will still be I. But we will not have these same bodies. Paul is very bold and emphatic about this. He calls the people who don't see this foolish men. Paul sometimes does seem to be a little bit arrogant, but I don't think he's being arrogant. He's just trying to get people to see that they are not able to look at the wood for the trees. And in this case, the tree, particularly, which people focus on, is this one problem that once the body decomposes, how does the personality survive? And people latch onto this one argument, and they can't see any further. And so they dismiss the idea of resurrection, or resurrection involving the personality surviving. But Paul stands back and looks at the wood. That is, he looks at the whole broad perspective of life after death from the point of view of the Creator God, and what God is, and what he's done in creation, and what he's done in history. And in the light of what God is, and the sort of God God is, resurrection becomes something we can conceive and believe to be possible. So Paul really uses three arguments, which we're now going to look at, to hammer home the point that there is continuation of the personality. The first two arguments he takes from creation, because he's showing the sort of power that God has in creation. And he's arguing that if God can do this in the material world here and now, can he not do this in the new world? Cannot God recreate just as he has created? And he says, even on earth here and now, we see a sort of picture of what God can do in the future. And he takes an example of the seed and the flower. He takes wheat as his particular example in verse 37. And in verse 36 he says, first of all, what you sow does not come to life unless it dies. Then verse 37, and what you sow is not the body, but what is to be, which is to be, but a bare kernel, perhaps of wheat, or some other grain. And he's saying this, that a plant exists in two forms, but it is the one plant. First, it exists as a seed. Secondly, it exists as a plant. But it is the one plant all the time. And God gives it two totally different forms. Perhaps a more dramatic example is something like a daffodil, because that has got a very ugly and uninteresting bulb and a very beautiful, lovely flower. Now the two are bound up together. If there was no bulb, there would never be a daffodil. And yet they are very different. The one thing has two very different appearances. It takes on two different outward forms in its lifetime. Now, if God does that in creation, can he not do that with us, says Paul? Here on earth, as it were, we have one form of existence. Our personality is expressed in a way in our earthly bodies, rather like a seed or a bulb. Compared with what we are to be, this is still very uninteresting and unattractive. And God has another way in which we are to appear. Our personalities are to be expressed. We don't yet know what it is going to be, but we know it will be as greater and more wonderful as a daffodil is to a bulb. The God who does this in creation will do this for us in eternity. His second argument is really an extension of this. And he says, take a look round at all the different forms in which life is expressed. See how God has made different types of body for different creatures and different material forms. He says in verse 39, first of all, take a look at things like animals. Take a look at birds. Take a look at fish. They've all got a different body, all adapted by the Creator perfectly to fit their environment. Stand back from this world and look out to the universe. See the vastness of it all. See the stars. See the sun. See the moon. And see how God has created these different types of material existence. Now, if God can do that in creation, cannot God do that in recreation? If God is so resourceful and has got so many different designs, as it were, up his sleeve in creation, cannot God extend this quite beyond our imagination when he recreates things? God is not limited. God has not got small resources. See already in creation, in the universe, in the tiny things that he's made, in the great things that he's made, the power and the resources of God. And that God is the God who is organizing the resurrection. And it is no problem to him to fit us with a new type of body, a new type of expression of our personality. God the Creator is well able to do it. Paul's third argument comes from Christ. In the first part of the chapter, which we looked at last week, the argument about our resurrection, Paul carries back to the resurrection of Christ. This is his key. It's his key to showing to mankind we are to be raised. Christ was raised, therefore we will be raised. Because Christ is the first example of resurrected humanity. Now in the second part of the chapter, Christ's resurrection becomes the clue to our own resurrection body. It is only a clue, but it helps us to understand a little bit more. Now we need to pick out some of the verses from this second part. Let's look first of all at verse 52. And just the very last sentence of that verse is the clue here to what will happen when the resurrection of all mankind comes. We shall be changed. Christ has been changed, but he still exists. His change, as it were, took part in a twofold stage. When the resurrection came, his body was transformed, but it was still, as it were, halfway between an ordinary earthly body and a resurrection body. When he ascended into heaven, it was changed more fully. It then became a heavenly body fitted for his heavenly existence. So Christ was changed from having a physical body like yours and mine to having a heavenly body. So too we shall be changed. The sort of body we get, Paul calls a spiritual body in verse 44. He emphasizes the point, if there is a physical body, there is also a spiritual body. The Creator God not only makes spiritual, physical bodies, he also makes spiritual bodies. He's already demonstrated it by doing it with Christ. He has changed Christ's physical body into a spiritual body. Thus, the first man, Adam, became a living spirit, but the last Adam became a life-giving spirit. And he has now become the man of heaven. There's that phrase in verse 48. The man of heaven. And so it is, says Paul, with all those who are born of heaven. What happened to Christ will happen to us. Just as his body was changed, our body will be changed. Now already, this is a frustrating sermon in the sense that one is all the time grasping to try and picture this resurrection body, and we can't. We've got all these analogies, all these clues. We're beginning to fit the picture together. We're beginning to see how it is possible for the Creator God to give us a spiritual body, how he's able to do that. We can see how he's already done it in Christ, because Christ ascended with his physical body and it became a spiritual body. But nobody saw the spiritual body and nobody could describe it. And we've not yet got anything that our imaginations can grasp. And neither do we get anything. And that is because it is beyond our imagination. We cannot imagine the heavenly realm. We can see something of the reality of it, but we can't imagine it. It's rather like trying to explain to a tadpole what it's going to be like to be a frog. It's a world beyond the tadpole's understanding. Can only be understood by the tadpole when he experiences the change and becomes a frog. We will only understand what God is going to do when we experience the change, as we will if we are committed Christians and we receive our spiritual bodies. Nevertheless, the assurance that we are going to be raised, the conviction that this is something real and not some pious escapist thinking, and the realization that we will be like Christ are all absolutely crucial in our thinking about the resurrection. If I can just quote from 1 John and leave this chapter just for a moment. John, in his first letter, has this verse, chapter 3 and verse 2, which I think hammers home this point about likeness to Christ. Beloved, we are God's children now. It does not yet appear what we shall be. It's beyond our imagination. We can't understand it. But we know, we're not only guessing, we know that when he appears, when Christ returns, and the new creation comes into being, we shall be like him. That is what we're told again and again in the Bible, here by Paul, there by John. We shall be like him. And this is now what Paul begins to enlarge on a little bit. Although he's not going to give us a picture of the spiritual body that we can imagine, because it's beyond our imagination, he is going to tell us four things about the spiritual body, which are true because we shall be like Christ. And knowing these four things will be a great encouragement to us. It's in verse 42 that he starts this list. And his first point is that the resurrection body is imperishable. One of the problems with the body on earth is that almost from the moment we're born, it's beginning to decay, and it is certainly subject to ill health and accident. Few people, if any, have perfect bodies, and no perfect body remains one for very long. It's soon in decay. So our experience of the body on earth is very much one of weakness, sickness, limitation. The resurrection body will never be like that. It will always be incorruptible, imperishable, perfect. Secondly, the resurrection body is glorious. Verse 43, it is sown in dishonor, that is, our physical body is tainted by dishonor. It is raised in glory. This dishonor comes from sin. Every one of us is gripped by the problem of our indwelling selfishness. and our sin. So our body is used for stealing, for fighting, for lying, for hurting, for dishonoring God. And however much as Christians we're growing like Christ, the frustration of our body and all its temptations pulling us back and leading us astray is one of the great problems of the Christian, the tension the Christian lives in, wanting to be like Christ, yet a body which keeps betraying him, keeps betraying her, keeps letting us down. Our body leads us astray. Not so the resurrection body. It'll be raised in glory. Sin's grip will be broken once and for all. And our new spiritual body will be free from this principle of indwelling sin, and therefore will be a glorious body. Thirdly, the resurrection body is powerful. It is sown in weakness, but it's raised in power. One of the frustrations we experience in our earthly bodies is that they will not do what they want, what we want them to do. Not only will they not sin, not stop sinning, but they won't do what is good. All of us have this sense, don't we, of wanting to be more and do more than our bodies will allow us to do. We want to create things. We want to achieve things. We want to do things. But our body keeps getting in the way. That is true physically. We can't achieve what we'd like to achieve. True mentally. We want to think far more, understand far more, work out far more, but we can't. Our limited minds seem to constrict us. And spiritually, don't we want to do so much more for God? Don't we want to be so much more powerful and effective? But all the time, our aspirations are brought crashing down as we face reality, and our tired, lazy, limited bodies and minds. And we know that when the resurrection comes, whatever form the spiritual body takes, it will be a perfect expression of all that we want to be, and all that we want to do. And that really is Paul's last point. If there is a physical body, there is also a spiritual body. And a spiritual body, it seems to me, is one which expresses the Spirit perfectly. Now, when we see Christ face to face, our spirits will be perfected. All thought of sin will fall away, and we will become like him. And at the same time, we will be given a body to express our perfected spirit, to express the love of God now filling us, to express the joy, the freedom, the fullness of life in Christ. One is straining for words because we're straining at the concept, but there will be a resurrection body free from sin and free from the limitations of this world. Having said that much, Paul is satisfied. He's thrilled people by the idea that there is certainly to be a resurrection for each one of us. Individually we will survive. We will have a means of expressing our individuality. And our new body will be, in whatever form it takes, will be free from those limitations and frustrations of this earthly life. Now, having said that, he can tell us no more. And he becomes deadly practical about this world. 2 points he makes. Firstly, one of praise and thanksgiving. In verses 55, 56, and 57, he talks about the victory. See the resurrection, he says, as the climax of the victorious life we enter into as Christians. There's sometimes a lot of cheap and easy talk amongst Christians about a victorious life. It isn't attained on earth in the sense that the Christian can never stand back and say, I have got the victory. Everything is now perfect and victorious. All we can say on earth is, I'm experiencing something of the power of the victory of Christ. But we know that this present experience is leading us on to the perfect victory. It is the guarantee that the victory is finally to be ours. Death is swallowed up in victory. Because of this, says Paul, let your life become a positive, thankful, rejoicing life. We see this evidence sometimes by those believers who are suffering more than we are. In the Russian prison camp, in the last war, the stories of somebody like Corrie ten Boom, in some of the massacres that have gone on in our own generation, the believers have exemplified this victory as they faced death, victorious and rejoicing. It's harder, in a way, to live it out in daily life, not facing imminent death, yet to have this tremendous sense of living on the brink of victory, because we are sharing Christ's victory. But we need to gain that sense of living in the victory, sharing the victory now and going on inevitably to the full victory which Christ has won on the cross. Positive rejoicing because of the hope of the resurrection, transforming life here and now. One of the great criticisms that people have made of Christianity is that it's pie in the sky when you die. And that if you're taken up with thinking about heaven, you're not going to face the practical problems of life. Now, sadly, that has been true of some Christians, but it is not the biblical perspective. And so Paul goes on in this second point to hammer home that if we are Christians, it's going to make a positive difference to the way we tackle life here and now, knowing there is a heaven, knowing there is a resurrection. Therefore, he says in verse 58, my beloved brethren, be steadfast and immovable. That's because the victory is won. Nothing can shake us. We can stand rock-like in the face of death. And then he goes on, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing that in the Lord your labor is not in vain. Paul's great incentive for going on working for Christ was the knowledge that his labor was not in vain. How easy it is to be disillusioned in life. How many idealists fade out of their great fight because they become disillusioned. Now, Christians can suffer from this. We can feel when we're young, we can take the world on. We can evangelize here and evangelize there. We can prove God here and prove him there. And we hit reality. We hit the tremendous grip that evil has on our world and on individuals. And we can become disillusioned and opt out of the fight. Not Paul, because he was unable to be disillusioned, because his position was that in the Lord, your labor is not in vain. Because seeing life from the perspective of this world is only half the story. Eternity will reveal what has fully been achieved in this life. So Paul never despaired. Wherever he preached, wherever he met people, he saw everything as an opportunity that would lead to eternal results. Not that he would know always what those eternal results were, but he was convinced that there would be eternal results. Firstly, there would be eternal results in his own life. This is true for us as Christians, that as we go on working for Christ, however crushed, however difficult, however hard things are, there are eternal results. We are becoming somebody. God is making us a unique individual. He is fulfilling our personality, and in the resurrection they will be perfectly expressed. But it is in the toil and the struggle of life that we become the people that God wants us to be. But secondly, there are to be eternal results in the lives of others. Paul was always convinced of that the gospel would bear some fruit. What an encouragement that is for us as we press on in our own realm, working for Christ. It's so hard to go on loving that unresponsive neighbor. Maybe for years we've struggled to get through and nothing seems to have happened. In the Lord, your labor is not in vain. Eternity will only reveal what has happened. It's so hard trying to pray and work for that friend. We've longed to come to Christ. It's hard to go on fighting for the gospel in some corner of the world where maybe there seem to be no results, possibly in this country, possibly in some corner of the mission field. But none of this would have deterred Paul, and none of this can deter the Christian. For in the Lord, our labor is not in vain. That word labor involves the meanings of toil, trouble, suffering, pain, and weariness. The Christian who's working for Christ and following Christ flat out will experience all these things, toil, trouble, suffering, pain and weariness, disappointment, despair, discouragement, problem after problem and trial after trial. There will be good things as well. There will be breakthroughs. There will be experience of visible and obvious results on earth. But much of the time, the toil. But it's not in vain. in eternity, it'll all make sense. We will see results. In eternity, we will see others who have been won through our influences on earth. Maybe not influences we knew, letters we wrote, things we said, attitudes we took up, examples borne by us. In the Lord, they bear fruit, and eternity will reveal it. So it is that the hope of the resurrection is a hope which can make us strong, steadfast, and immovable in our Christian lives here and now. In the face of discouragement and uncertainty, we need to look ahead to a very real spiritual world. Also, we need to be driven on to work for Christ, not getting discouraged, because we know that eternity will reveal results which we do not see here and now. And the promise of God is that in the Lord, our labor, toil, and struggle is not in vain. And one day, we will see that that is true.